If you're interested in astronomy, cosmology, a new picture of a giant black hole was published today. And our people here are involved in this. That's how I know it from a student. It's a picture of the black hole or the photosphere of the black hole M87. If you're not familiar with this, this is a giant one. This is huge. The Schwarzschild radius is bigger than our entire solar system. For comparison, our own galaxy, the Milky Way, also has a central black hole, but it's tiny in comparison. Its radius, its Schwarzschild radius, is smaller than the distance from the Sun to Mercury. It's way smaller. It's like a tenth of that. It's like 100 light seconds from the center of the Earth, from the Sun, whereas M87 has a Schwarzschild radius that's about a light day. So if you fell across the horizon of M87 central black hole, then you would live at least a day. You could think about it for a day, you know. That.
But if you are falling at the speed of light, then that one.
Yeah, I don't know how much you can extend your stay, the happiest part of your stay in the black hole. I don't know. That would be an interesting thing to do. Maybe we can do that when we later in the course get to black holes.
Yeah.
Right, so then third announcement, what is the role of this lecture today? Still a preliminary lecture. Before we get into the meat of things, where we build up the formalism and then go on to cosmology and black holes. Today's lecture is about the Schrödinger equation for quantum field theory. It's not something that we will use in cosmology, but I think it's worth knowing about this, so we will do it today. So today, the purpose of today's lecture is to get to the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory and use it to give you an alternative way of calculating the quantum fluctuations in a quantum field of the vacuum or also of an excited state. This is not something that we are going to build on later in this course. It's just for information. It's another way of looking at quantum field theory. And you may wonder, oh, we just got rid of the Schrödinger equation. We upgraded to the Klein-Gordon and Dirac equations. Why again the Schrödinger equation? Well, the reason is that the Schrödinger equation has nothing to do with non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Now, some people might think otherwise. They might think this is at the heart of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, but that's not so. The Schrödinger equation holds for every quantum theory, everyone. And the Schrödinger equation is always of the form I h bar d by dt psi of t equal to h hat, possibly time dependent, and then psi of t. Now, remember, we saw in the previous lecture that there is a Hamiltonian for quantum field theory, a Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon theory. And when you use that Hamiltonian, you get this as a Schrödinger equation. So that means the Schrödinger equation has really nothing to do with what you think of when you think Schrödinger equation in the quantum mechanical non-relativistic case. That's just a special case. The Schrödinger equation governs every quantum theory, and it simply says that the time evolution of a quantum state, and this could be the quantum state of a quantum field theory, could be the quantum state of all quantum field theories, like the standard model particles, could be the quantum state of gravity, the quantum state of whatever quantum theory you're considering in the Schrödinger picture, where the states evolve in time, in the Schrödinger picture, that time evolution is governed by this equation. Every quantum theory, including quantum field theory, is a Hamiltonian. And if you choose the Schrödinger picture, the states are evolving in time. And that's what governs it. This theory can be the Dirac theory. This theory can be the Klein-Gordon theory. This theory can be the Maxwell equations, the quantum Maxwell equations, right? All quantum theories have a Schrödinger equation. And today we will see the one for the Klein-Gordon theory. Yep.
I just had a preliminary question. Looking over last lecture's notes, you said that okay, we can write a Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon theory. What comes first? It seems that most Hamiltonians in QFT, you know the equations of motion, and then you backward engineer the Hamiltonian so that you get these equations of motion.
Initially, that's how it was done. But nowadays, it's different. Nowadays, we consider what could the Hamiltonian be as the starting point. And the guiding principle for that is usually symmetry. So, for example, for the strong interaction, there's an SU3 symmetry. And that governs how the Hamiltonian has to look. Right? So if you think about it, there is a hierarchy of abstraction. So there are the equations of motion, and they can be derived from a Hamiltonian, and then the Hamiltonian can be derived from a symmetry principle. There are speculations about where the symmetries come from, but no conclusive answer about that. That might be the final step we have to do. You know, find out why the Hamiltonian that we have in nature has the particular symmetries that it has. That's still a starting point. We cannot derive that yet. So let's get back to this picture here of the waves on a pond and as an analogy of waves in a quantum field, such as the electromagnetic field or the Klein-Gordon field. And let's get back to the question of the quantum fluctuations in the quantum field. Here we have water waves, and it's clear how we can visualize that. For quantum fields, I already showed you a plot last time of how the quantum fluctuations look. You can, for example, plot a contour plot of the amplitudes of the field that you measure in a snapshot at time, at a particular point in time. And that's what we will be concerned with today. How do you calculate the probability distribution of these field configurations? I already indicated last time one way how you can calculate that. And today we will do another way. Yes, on Tuesday we did it in the Heisenberg picture, and today we will do that in the Schrödinger picture. Conceptually, if we are interested in the amplitudes of a field of waves on a pond that we describe, let's say, as amplitudes phi of x and t, then if we want to measure what the amplitude is at the point, we can throw a cork in the water, and its height as a function of time tells us phi as a function of time. And we can put a cork everywhere, so we get phi of x and t. But how would we do the analog of that for a quantum field? What's the cork? No, the field would be like the electromagnetic field, but what could be the cork? And what could be the quark is, for example, an atom, or a molecule, or an individual particle. But atoms are particularly convenient. So for example, when a wave passes and there's an atom in the way, the atom might get excited. And that excitation of the atom tells you, oh, a wave passed by. In fact, you can deduce that a photon passed by, or a photon was actually absorbed. And similarly, of course, this thing can create waves. We will do that in detail in Lecture 8, where we will study emission and absorption processes. That is to say, we will study the quantum theory of an atom coupled to the quantum theory of the electromagnetic field, or the Klein-Gordon field. But for now, we will postpone the question of how we would actually go about measuring a field. And we will just assume that we can measure the field amplitude by whatever means. I'm just indicating that this is one way to do it. But for now, let's just say we can measure the amplitude. I mean, obviously, we can measure the electric field, we can measure the magnetic field. But if you get down to the quantum nature of things, it becomes non-trivial. So we assume that we have some means to measure the field amplitude. And what do we mean by that? Phi hat of x and t. So remember that for every x, we have a harmonic oscillator that has a time dependence. Still the Heisenberg picture here. And so the phi hat of x, that is for every choice of x, this is an operator. This is an observable, in fact, because it is self-adjoint. So for every x, we have an operator. This is similar to ordinary quantum mechanics, where, for example, we have three position operators, or three momentum operators, three angular momentum operators. Let's say the three angular momentum operators, we would write them in this way. We would have L hat I. And then for I equal to 1, we have an operator. For I equal 2, we have an operator. For I equal to 3, we have an operator. And here, for every choice of x, we have an operator. Clearly, this is uncountably many operators there. And they are all self-adjoint. And they all commute with each other. This is part of the canonical commutation relations for quantum field theory, that the field amplitudes at equal time commute, no matter where. They all commute. It's only the phi with the phi dot that doesn't commute. The phi doesn't commute with the pi at equal time, at equal space. They don't commute. All right, so remember then that when in ordinarily in quantum mechanics, already in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, when you have two observables, two self-adjoint operators that commute with each other, then you can measure them both simultaneously. It's only the non-commuting ones that have a non-trivial uncertainty principle. And so if you measure one, you can't really know the other. But if they commute, then there is no uncertainty principle in the way, and you can measure them both simultaneously. Here, that means that in principle, you can measure the amplitude of your quantum field, in this case, the phi hat, the Klein-Gordon field. You can measure that everywhere. If you measure it simultaneously at one point in time, you measure the amplitude of your field everywhere, then you get a measurement value everywhere. So you have uncountably, infinitely many measurement values that you get. In practice, of course, you can't measure the field at a point because every measurement instrument has a finite extent, even the tiniest ones. But conceptually, in principle, you could measure the amplitude everywhere at one point in time, let's say. Now, when we do that, if we measure all those observables, remember that the quantum field at every point has phi hat as an observable. Pi hat is also an observable, because pi hat is also self-adjoint. But the phi hat of x is also self-adjoint, and we can measure it. We can measure it everywhere. So if we choose a particular point in time and then measure the field everywhere, the outcome is going to be a real number for every point x. In other words, we obtain a function. We obtain a real value function. So just like in quantum mechanics, you could, for example, for the hydrogen atom, you could measure L3, L squared, and the Hamiltonian, three observables simultaneously. Because they commute, you can measure them simultaneously. Three of them. And then you're done. You've measured everything. Except for the spin, if you consider that. Right? And then you're done. Here, you measure uncountably, infinitely many observables. And then you're done. So in quantum, for the hydrogen atom, three numbers. That's what you get. But you're done. Then you know what state it is, right? And in fact, I'll say that later. So you get infinitely many outcomes of these measurements. And if you collect them all, it's a function. Namely, for every point in R3, you get a real number, right? It's the measurement outcome. So what you found as the outcome of your measurement of the field everywhere is a function that we may call phi. Not to be confused with the phi hat. That's operator valued. Let's just call this phi for now. This is the function that describes the outcome of a measurement that we perform at some point in time. We measured all of the field amplitudes. Now remember that in quantum mechanics, if you measure for the hydrogen atom, for example, L3, L squared, and the energy, the Hamiltonian, once you've measured these three numbers, the system, the hydrogen atom, is going to be in that state that is described by L squared, by m, and by the energy En. Right? So whenever you've measured some observables, a maximal set of commuting observables, then after the measurement, the state collapsed into the state that is described by these measurement outcomes. So for hydrogen atom, no matter what state the hydrogen atom started out in, if you measure L3, L squared, and H. Then, after the measurement, the state collapses into an eigenstate of L3, L squared, and H. And that state can be described by the three quantum numbers, En, little l, little m. But also, you could, for example, for the hydrogen atom, no matter what the state of the hydrogen atom is, you could also measure the three momentum observables. They also commute. So you basically measure the momentum of the electron as it is around the proton. So you get three values. You get the p1, p2, p3. And after you've performed that momentum measurement, the state of our electron collapses into a momentum eigenstate with these three momenta there. Whenever you choose to measure something, the measurement outcome tells you what state the system is now in, because each measurement produces a state collapse. So here too, no matter what the state of the field was before we performed the measurement, could have been a vacuum state, could have been a state with all sorts of wave excitations going on. No matter what, after we performed the measurement, we obtain a real number for every location in space. And this is the set of all quantum numbers. Just like for the hydrogen atom, it's, you know, the outcome of the L3 measurement, the outcome of the L squared measurement, and the outcome of the energy measurement. These three numbers describe the state. And so here, it is those infinitely many amplitudes that we measured that together describe the state that the quantum field theory collapsed into. See, before that, it might have been in the vacuum state or whatever state. But afterwards, it's in an eigenstate of all those phi hat operators. There's a phi hat operator for every x. And since we measure it at the time that we choose, at that time, a state collapse happens, and the field is now in an eigenstate, or a joint eigenstate of all of those phi hat operators. I know it takes a little getting used to the fact that in quantum field theory, we don't just have like three as a maximum set of commuting observables. No, we have uncountably infinitely many of them. And of course, there are mathematical subtleties associated with that, but I'm glancing over them for the moment.
Whenever you measure, you are fixing that profile that you have.
Well, that would be one outcome, for example, right? So you perform a measurement. Let's say the field is in the vacuum state, whatever that means, we will later see. It's in that state. And then you measure the phi for the amplitude of the field at every location. You get a function, a real valued function that we may call phi, that tells you for every location in space, R3, what the amplitude is that you measured of the field. And then you can create a contour plot, for example, where the lines are the lines of equal phi value. So this is just like height, you know, like when you go hiking, then you have these topological maps, right? Topographic maps. All right, so after we perform a measurement of all the phi simultaneously, the state of the system collapses into this eigenstate, joint eigenstate of all of those phi hat observables, because every phi hat of x is an observable. And we measure the outcome, and then we are in an eigenstate of all these observables. And that eigenstate can be denoted by phi. It's a ket phi. It looks innocent like this, but it has a lot of information in it, right? Because this is an eigenstate of all of those phi hat operators. It's an eigenstate of the operator phi hat of x here, eigenstate of the operator phi hat of x prime over there, all of them. In particular, and that's the defining feature of it, if you take the phi hat observable at the location x, that's a self-adjoint operator, and you apply it to this state phi, well, then you get the eigenvalue that you measured previously at that location. This is the math of saying that this state is a joint eigenstate of all of those phi hat operators, and the collection of the eigenvalues for this collection of operators is this. This is the collection of the eigenvalues, the phi of x. So for example, let's assume that the system is in a vacuum state. Let's call this vacuum state omega. That's a common letter to be used for the vacuum state. Then what would be a typical measurement outcome if we measured the amplitude of the field everywhere at a particular point in time? Well, it could look like this, as we, as Matthäus already anticipated. And yeah, these are the level curves of the function phi of x. And as we discussed, this is really repetitive, just adding a picture to it. The state then, after it was the vacuum state before, it's later the state phi, which is a joint eigenstate of all the field operators. Yeah?
So, because in the lab scenario, we are measuring in a finite region. So that means the collapse happens only for those particular oscillators. But the entire field doesn't collapse to an eigenstate of the entire field unless we measure it all the points.
That's right. That's right. If we perform a localized measurement, then we only have a localized collapse as well. Yeah. Now, remember, this is the Schrödinger equation for all quantum theories. Now, let's remember briefly how we get the Schrödinger equation that you see in textbooks of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Well, the way you get the Schrödinger equation that is known from textbooks in books in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and by that I mean this equation, I h bar d by dt psi of x and t equal to, and then you have h hat of x hat, well, let's say x and minus I h bar d by dx acting on psi of x and t. Right? How do we get from here to there? Let me just remind you of how that goes, because we'll do the same thing here, but for quantum field theory, where the whole thing might look a little bit more opaque. So in the case of ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, what we have is that the set of all position eigenvectors forms an orthonormal basis. It's not exactly normalizable, but you know what I mean. It's a continuum's normalization. In fact, let's say we do this for three dimensions, just to illustrate it a bit better. So what we have here is the eigenvectors x1, x2, x3, for example. So this is a joint eigenvector to three position operators. And the set of all those give us a basis of the Hilbert space. And we can use that basis and multiply it from the left onto this equation. Then what we obtain is I h bar d by dt. And then we have x1, x2, x3, psi of t equal to x1, x2, x3, h hat of t, psi of t, right? Now this is having a name. We will also call this, usually call this x1, x2, x3, and t. That's the Schrödinger wave function in the position representation. Here, though, we have this h hat in between. All right, so what we do is this, I h bar d by dt. And then here, we insert a resolution of the identity, dx tilde 1, dx tilde 2, dx tilde 3. And then we have x1, x2, x3, h hat of t, and now the resolution of the identity. So, sorry, it goes like this. We have x tilde 1, x tilde 2, x tilde 3, x tilde 1, x tilde 2, x tilde 3, and psi of t. So this is psi of x tilde 1, x tilde 2, x tilde 3, and t. And here, if you evaluate all of this, then you find that this is then what we had over here. This is h hat, and then you have the x1, the x2, and the x3, and minus ih bar d by dx1, minus ih bar d by dx2, minus ih bar d by dx3. Right? That's a bit of a step, but I assume that you've seen that in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, how that's done, how that matrix element is calculated. If you haven't seen this or don't remember it, you can also go to my homepage on the left sidebar, teaching, and then my course on advanced quantum mechanics and the lecture notes, and it's all worked out in great detail how that comes about. Okay, so in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that's how all of this happens. Now, here we want to do something similar. Work in the Schrödinger picture. But what on earth is the analog of the position representation now? You see, in quantum field theory, the position, the axes, are just parameters, just like the time. There's no position operator. No, in quantum field theory, the quantum degrees of freedom are the phi hat. Right? And we have tons of them, not just three. We have, for every location, we have another phi hat. Here we have three position operators, and we look at the joint eigenbases of the three position operators. Here, this is a joint eigenvector of all of the phi hat operators. The phi hats are now our observables. These are the joint eigenvectors. And each one of them is a basis vector. Right? So if we choose different functions, you see, these phi are functions from R3 into R, and there could be any function, in fact, not just the continuous ones. Phi could be any function, and then we get lots of states for any function, for any field configuration. That's the name of it, right? If you measure all the phi hat at once, you find an amplitude here and there and everywhere you find an amplitude. And this set of amplitudes gives you a field configuration. And for every field configuration, we have a phi, a function that gives us the amplitude as a function of where we are, and a state phi that has exactly this function as its set of eigenvalues. So if you look at all of those vectors, for all the functions phi that map from R3 into R, for all collections of eigenvalues that you might have measured, for all collections of amplitudes that you might have measured, this set is also an orthonormal set. They're orthonormal because if you measure different field configurations, then it means you have found different eigenvalues. And as always, eigenvectors to different eigenvalues are orthogonal. So these guys are orthogonal to each other. For different functions phi, you have different orthogonal vectors. And in a sense that is hard to make, to explain technically, they actually form a complete orthonormal basis. I'm simplifying things here a lot because it's a continuum of observables and lots of issues arise. But in principle, what we have is that we have that the set of all those phi form in basis, and therefore I can use them to create a resolution of the identity. Let me remind you of how a resolution of the identity looks in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Here, for example, we chose this eigenbasis of all the joint eigenbasis of all the three position operators. And then we can use them to write down a resolution of the identity integral d, well, dx1, dx2, dx3, and then x1, x2, x3, x1, x2, x3, right? And you know, then what we can do is we can say that psi is equal to the identity times psi is equal to the integral d3x. I'm just simplifying this. And then we have here x, x psi. And then this is psi of x1, x2, x3. Right? And so what we have is that this is equal to integral d3x psi of x vector, just another notation for this, and then x vector. Okay, so we have that psi of x vector is equal to this, right? And we arrived at that using the resolution of the identity. Now, here in quantum field theory, very similar. Instead of having the joint eigenstates of these of the three observables x1 and x2 and x3, we now have these that are joint eigenstates of all the field observables, phi hat here, phi hat there, and so on. And if we take the collection of all of those, we get effectively a basis of the Hilbert space. So we can write down a state now, an arbitrary state that the quantum field theory might be in. Let's call that state psi. We can write it as resolution of the identity, so the integral over all possible choices of these phi vectors. And then here the inner product between phi and psi. Psi is an arbitrary state. And then, well, we integrate over all possible phi vectors, which means we integrate over all possible field configurations now. Here, we're just integrating over like three numbers because we only have three observables that we jointly diagonalized. Here, we are jointly diagonalizing an uncountable number of infinitely many observables. So actually, this is a path integral, because we are integrating here over all possible field configurations. Now, remember what we found here. Here we found, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that the wave function is this inner product between a position eigenvector, that is to say, a basis vector, and the state, an arbitrary state, that the system might be in. So psi is the state that the system might be in. This is the basis vector, and that's the wave function. And what's the meaning of the wave function? Well, the meaning of the wave function is that it is the probability amplitude that if you measure the three position observables in this case, that you find that outcome, namely these three numbers, assuming that the state of the system is psi. What would be the analog of that? What would be a wave function for quantum field theory? Again, we expect that it's a probability, it gives us probability amplitudes for something that might happen. Here, what might happen is that we find one value for the x1 coordinate, for the x1 position operator, another one for the, another value for the y position, another one for the z position, right? And we get the probability amplitudes for any of these outcomes there. Here, we are measuring not just three variables, observables. Here, we are measuring uncountably many. We are measuring a field configuration. And that means that a wave function in quantum field theory gives us a probability amplitude for an entire field configuration to be measured. Right? So a wave function now tells us what is the probability amplitude that if I measure the field configuration, If I measure the phi hat of x for all x, if I measure the amplitude everywhere, that I get a particular configuration. So here, I can, for example, ask, well, what's the probability amplitude that I find the location I don't know, 1.2, 7.4, 9.7, right? In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that would be the probability for finding the electron there. The probability amplitude for it, if I square it, I get the probability for it, or the probability density for it, right? Here, I'm expecting that the wave functional gives me the probability amplitude for finding that if I measure the field amplitude everywhere, that I find it to take, I don't know, like this amplitudes or whatever, you know, something hilly. I'm just making up something, right? I'm picking a function phi of x arbitrarily, a field configuration, where the amplitude is strong here, weak there, oh, even negative over there, right? I make up some field configuration. I make up some possible outcome of measuring the field amplitude everywhere. And then I ask, what's the probability that I'm actually going to find this? Or the probability density that I'm actually going to find this? This is going to be what a quantum field theoretical wave function gives me. Just like a quantum mechanical wave function gives me for quantum mechanics here. So the wave functional. Right, you know that this is just a reminder of quantum mechanics. Now, quantum field theory. So remember that for every location in space, we have an observable. We have a harmonic oscillator, and it has observables like phi hat and pi hat. And so we have, for every location in space, we have this observable phi hat. And all of them commute with each other. We can measure them simultaneously, a complete set of commuting observables. And their joint eigenvectors we call phi. And they are eigenvectors. Each phi is a joint eigenvector to all these observables. And what are its eigenvalues? Well, they're given by this ordinary function from R3 into R, right? So if you apply the observable, the amplitude observable at a particular location to this state phi, then you find, ah, phi is an eigenvector to this observable and with eigenvalue phi of x. So phi of x describes, as usual, the field configuration. So now imagine that psi. Now we want a wave functional, right? A wave function for quantum field theory. And let's call that psi. So instead of having a psi of x here, we get a psi of a field configuration. So let's assume that the system, the quantum field, is in a quantum state psi, which could be any state, vacuum state or something going on, anything. So the state of the quantum field is, let's say, called psi. Then if we calculate the overlap with the state phi, which is one of those joint eigenvectors to all of the amplitude observables, then we call this psi of phi in the same way that here we define psi of x. Because here we are measuring the x hat observables. Here we are measuring the phi hat observables. So psi of phi is the overlap of one of these eigenstates, joint eigenstates of all the field operators, with the arbitrary state psi of the system. So psi of phi is the probability amplitude, or probability amplitude density, that I will find the field configuration phi described by a function from R3 into R, phi, if the system is prepared in the state psi. Right? That's what it is. This is a wave functional. Assuming the quantum field is in the state psi, then the probability for finding a field configuration described by a function phi from R3 into R, field configuration phi, the probability for finding it, or probability amplitude for finding it, is this overlap here. And we call it psi of phi. I'm using square brackets here because it is what is called a functional. It's the same as a function. However, instead of having just a discrete set of variables, you have a continuous set of variables because you have the phi everywhere. You plug in a function, actually, right? It's the phi, which is a function from R3 into R. So that's the wave functional. So for example, you might prepare the quantum system in some state and then ask, what's the probability that I find that the amplitude of the field is 0.5 everywhere? Well, then your field, you're asking what the probability is to find the field configuration where the amplitude of the field is 0.5 everywhere. That field configuration is described by a function phi from R3 into R, which maps every point into 0.5. So that's a particular state, right? And so you take your state that you prepared the field in, and you calculate the overlap with that state that is described by that function. It maps all of R3 into 0.5. And you get some amplitude, and that's the probability amplitude density for finding that outcome. And you may wonder, how on earth can we calculate that? So that's what we will do next. You see, it's all good and fine to make definitions like this, but if you want to know how this behaves, how do we calculate that, you need the Schrödinger equation for that. So now we need the Schrödinger equation for these wave functionals, because just like the psi of x and t changes over time according to the Schrödinger equation, the wave functional also changes over time in general. I mean, obviously, you could, for example, have the field in a state where you have a bunch of particles that are on their way over there. In that case, clearly the probability distribution for field configurations should be time dependent. Because if the particles are all here, I expect a higher probability for finding elevated amplitudes here. And when the particles are over there, then I'm expecting, you know, that there's a higher probability for large amplitudes later over there. We will later see how the relationship goes between fields and particles. But for now, it's just the fields. Okay, so what is the interpretation of psi of phi, the wave functional? Again, assume that the system is in arbitrary state that we may call psi, and at time t. Now we measure all of the observables, all of the amplitude observables of the field at that point in time t. And then we ask, what's the probability amplitude for finding the outcomes phi of x? You know, one outcome for every x, for every location. And the answer is the probability, or more precisely, the probability density for finding that particular outcome is given by this overlap, psi with phi, and then squared in order to go from a probability amplitude to a probability. But what is the equation of motion for this wave functional? How does it behave as a function of time? Well, it's the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory that governs the evolution. Because every quantum theory has this, right? So if psi is the state of your quantum field theory and you know the Hamiltonian, here is how you can calculate the time evolution of it. And then you may want to know, let's say you've calculated what psi of t is, but this is now the state of the quantum field theory. It describes all the particles, all the waves, everything at once. Right? It describes everything that's going on. And imagine you've solved the Schrödinger equation. You found this. And you want to know, what about my probability amplitudes? Well, you calculate that overlap here with these joint eigenvectors. You calculate that, right? The psi is time dependent, but but you calculate the overlap with that. Just like in ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the position eigenvectors do not depend on time, because the position operators do not depend on time. I can just recycle them at any point in time, and I can define at any point in time the position wave function. Where is it? Here, right? This might be a function of time. But the position eigenvectors are not. So here, we are working in the Schrödinger picture. So the phi hat are not depending on time. The phi hat by the Schrödinger picture are frozen because they're observables. It's the state that evolves in time. OK, so what is the equation of motion then for the state of the quantum field theory? It's the Schrödinger equation. And as we discussed here on the board, for every quantum theory, we have that in the Schrödinger picture of the time evolution, we have that this is the equation of motion. Now, which form does it take for the wave function L? Now, let's remember the Hamiltonian that we found for the quantum field theory, for the Klein-Gordon theory. The Hamiltonian was the momentum operators, I mean the canonically conjugate momentum fields, pi hat squared plus the phi hat of x, and then here we had minus the Laplacian plus m squared, and then the amplitude field again. This is almost exactly the Hamiltonian that we had written down previously. It's that Hamiltonian from which you can derive the Klein-Gordon equation, right? The only change is that now it's written in the Schrödinger picture. And in the Schrödinger picture, this is no longer dependent on time. The phi and the pi used to be time dependent in the Heisenberg picture, but in the Schrödinger picture, they are not. So there's no time dependence in here. OK, so that's the Hamiltonian in the Schrödinger picture. And what we want to do is we want to do this, right? We have the Hamiltonian acting on the state, which is a function of time. That's the equation that governs it all. But remember that in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we don't usually solve the equation on this level of abstraction. Instead, we choose the position representation so that then the Schrödinger equation takes the usual form. Where is it? Here it is, right? We use the position representation, and then we have that the position operators are represented just by multiplying with x, and the momentum operators are represented by minus I h bar d by dx. And that's a useful thing to have, because this abstract Schrödinger equation becomes a very concrete partial differential equation once you write it down in the position representation. And then we can use all the machinery from the theory of partial differential equations to solve the Schrödinger equation. Of course, it doesn't matter in which basis we calculate things, but the position basis is usually very convenient, especially because the potential is usually, if there is a potential, written in the position basis. So here, too, we have this abstract Schrödinger equation. But in order to actually calculate things, maybe we should choose a basis. But what basis could we choose? Remember, there's no position basis anymore. Positions and time are just parameters. No, we can use the basis that we've been yapping about all the time, which is the basis of the phi hat, right? The eigenbasis of all of the phi hat operators, the basis of these phi vectors here. And if we choose that basis and it corresponds to the choice of the position basis in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, then what happens to the Schrödinger equation? How does this Schrödinger equation look explicitly? You see, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, this is the abstract Schrödinger equation. And then when we choose the position basis, we find that the Hamiltonian, which contains position and momentum operators, in the position basis, contains x's as multiplication operators and the p's simply as differentiation operators. So maybe we find something similar here. And indeed, that's what we find. It's just not multiplication by x and differentiation with respect to x. No, we're not using an x basis here. We're using a phi basis, a phi eigenbasis. So what we should expect is that the Hamiltonian that depends on the phi and the pi fields will be Hamiltonian in terms of multiplying with phi and functionally differentiating with respect to phi. That's what we will find. So we have the phi and the pi occurring in the Hamiltonian, just like we have the x and the p occurring in the Hamiltonian in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the q and the p, or the x and the p, are represented as multiplication with x and minus ih bar d by dx for a particular reason. And the reason is, of course, that we need to represent this. Right? We need to represent this. And we can represent it in the x basis. We can represent it in this way, that we say that x acts on psi of x, x hat acts on psi of x by just multiplying. In fact, let's add indices, because there we have indices. In fact, they run through a continuum, right? We have so many. So let's keep track of that. And we have that p hat I acting on psi of x is equal to minus ih bar d by dxi psi of x. Why? Well, it's because if you calculate xi minus ih bar d by dxi, psi of x, x and t, minus ih bar d by d xi psi of x and t, you will find that this is ih bar psi of x and t. And why is that? It's because here we have x times the derivative. Here we have the derivative times x. The derivative acts, in fact, on both of them, right? And so what we have is that there's a term where the xi, I mean, this produces two terms, right? It differentiates the product of the two. One where this is just annihilated, and we get the psi, that's this term. And one term where the xi is not differentiated, and instead that is differentiated. That term kills this one. So in other words, the fact that we have here x and the derivatives is just a direct consequence of needing to represent this. Now, here in quantum field theory, we don't have that. The x's are just parameters. So what do we have in quantum field theory? There we have this. We need to represent that. And how can we do that? Well, in the same way, we now have that when we take the phi hat of x and act with it on a wave functional, right? Remember wave functional? It gives you for every field configuration the probability amplitude for finding it. And let that act as simply multiplication on the wave functional, complete analog to this, right? So the x acts on the wave function as multiplying with x. And we let the pi hat operator act on the wave functional as minus I and then derivative with respect to phi. I'm using these other deltas here to indicate that this is a functional derivative, just the same type that you use in order to derive the Euler Lagrange equations, for example. If you take this functional derivative here, then you can show that the same happens as what happened here. You first multiply, then differentiate. That's not the same as first differentiating, then multiplying. In other words, multiplication and differentiation are not commutative. And by choosing these two actions, if you represent phi hat in the field representation as multiplication with the field, and if you represent pi in the field representation, you know, the representation of these vectors, the phi vectors, as functional differentiation, then they obey these commutation relations. Now remember that in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger equation, the abstract Schrödinger equation, is this one, as always, in every quantum theory. But then when you choose the position representation, the Hamiltonian represents, in the position representation, all occurrences of position operators as multiplication with x, all occurrences of momentum operators as minus I h bar differentiating with respect to x. Here, same deal. We have this Hamiltonian, that's the abstract Hamiltonian. But if we write it down in the position representation, then every occurrence of the pi field is replaced by an occurrence of minus I d by d phi. And every occurrence of phi is replaced by multiplying with phi. So therefore, the Hamiltonian in the basis of the phi vectors, in that basis, the Hamiltonian takes this form. You see, the pi squared becomes minus, well, there should be an h bar squared, and then the second derivative with respect to the phi. And here we have multiplication with phi, multiplication with phi. Actually, it's more convenient to work in the momentum space, as we saw earlier. You look like you have a question, do you?
Well, I have one comment. It seems like the formalism is all nice, but I have a hard time imagining how I can compute anything with all these infinity. Well,
yeah, we'll get to that. We'll calculate something. I'll show you how it becomes concrete. Any other questions so far?
Yeah. Related to that. So we have these configurations as bases in a sense, right? Because we have now bases as well.
Yeah.
So does that mean that if I have a particular free configuration, I can actually represent as a linear combination of those bases in a sense?
It's easier. It's easier. Every field configuration gives you directly a basis vector. And if you take another field configuration, it gives you another basis vector. And then you could, for example, consider a linear combination of these two basis vectors, like a third of this and 0.7 of the other. I mean, you have to normalize it, right? What that means is that there's a probability amplitude for finding this field configuration and the probability amplitude for finding another field configuration. Right? And so you can build linear combinations of field configurations.
But then after resolute the identity, was it all well, two functions?
Oh, yeah. Functions. Yeah, that's right. Yes. So there is a huge number of these basis vectors, because for every field configuration, you get a basis vector. Yeah, and then you can also look at linear combinations of that. You could, for example, have a state of the electromagnetic field, where there's a probability amplitude for the electric field to go this way, and a probability amplitude for it to go the other way. So it's simultaneously both. It's like a Schrödinger's cat, where an atom could be here or there. It's not that we don't know where it is. It's actually in a superposition of being here or there. And similarly with fields. The electromagnetic field could be this, or it could be that, or another one. You can write down arbitrary linear combinations of field configurations. Now, all of that is pretty standard for fields of the standard model, electromagnetic fields, gluon fields, electronic fields, and so on. Where we are still struggling is doing the same thing for gravity. Because there, what it means is that there would be a field configuration, that is to say, a metric configuration, that is to say, a shape of a manifold. There could be a probability amplitude for having, if you measured it, the shape of the space-time to be this, or the shape of the space-time to be something else, right? And you might think, why not? Why not? Well, the thing is, how do you even compare that? You see, if you have an underlying space-time with a coordinate system on it, for example, then you could say, OK, the electromagnetic field could have this configuration with some probability amplitude and that configuration with some other probability amplitude. And you know exactly at this point, at this location, the amplitude could be this or it could be that. At this location, this. Or that, right? But if you have that the space-time metric, so the shape of the manifold could either be this, or it could had the probability for being something else. You can't even compare these points because you don't know which point on the one manifold corresponds to which point on the other.
Unless I have code of transformation from one to the other.
Yeah, but what would be a canonical one? So somehow the rug is pulled under our feet. And for example, Roger Penrose says that because of this, gravity should be classical. Basically, what he says is that there is something different about superpositions of the metric compared to superposition of the electromagnetic field. And the reason is that when this electromagnetic field is in non-trivial superpositions, then so what? That's usual quantum mechanics. But if the space-time is in linear superpositions, this also means in linear superpositions of causal structures, of light cones. And that means of logic, right? Because something is or is not in the past of something else. And so what Penrose argues, if I understood him correctly, talking right here at PI, is that that puts a constraint and prevents space-time from fluctuating in the way that electromagnetic fields can. I don't quite buy it. I think just because we can't imagine it yet, it can still happen.
Just a causal structure by itself puts a constraint.
Yes, the fact that we can't, he basically, if I understand him correctly, he basically claims you can't have probability amplitude for illogical things. But of course, now there's a whole field of quantum causal structures, and we now know that this is highly non-trivial. There are possibilities for ambiguities in, you know, whether A was before B and B was before A and so on. So that logic is still okay. But you can have superpositions of causal structures. But overall, you see, the main message I wanted to convey is it's non-trivial because with gravity, it's not as easy as with the other fields because gravity has an extra function because it defines causality. It defines the light cones. And therefore, it defines what can cause what.
You said in this case we can compare the different points, but are they not fixed? Are we not fixing the manifold and then...
Here we are.
Not
yes.
In the gravity case.
In the gravity case, if you want to do quantum fluctuations of gravity, it's a huge mess because you can't fix the underlying points. Well, you could formally, on paper, you could have a differential manifold where you put a coordinate system and then you put different metrics on it. But that's just one way of doing it, and you could choose a different coordinate system on that differential manifold and you shift with diffeomorphisms and then say I identify this way. There is no unique canonical map from the one to the other. Yes.
So the dimension of this space, the number of bases, eigenbasis states, that will depend upon the lab experiment scenario. Or it could be, it would always be infinite?
Well, as we discussed, without any ultraviolet, infrared cutoffs, it's really mathematically a bad mess. But if you put an infrared and an ultraviolet cutoff, then it becomes handleable. Not for gravity, because if you put it in a box, well, you know, it can still mushroom an entire universe in a little spot, right? So you can't confine gravity that easily. But without gravity, I mean, we will later see, we will have to, for the purpose of the standard model of cosmology, we will actually partially have to quantize gravity, at least fluctuations, small fluctuations of it. And then the problem will recur.
I mean, could there be lab experiments where, in that particular scenario, are there only 10 possible, 20 possible eigenstates?
I'm not sure. Oh. Okay, so there are lab experiments. For example, in Vienna, the group of Markus Aspelmeier is pursuing experiments in which they try to test whether gravity can confer entanglement. And there it would be very nice if we could just say, oh, we reduce everything to finite dimensional Hilbert space. I don't know whether they have achieved that. They're working on the experimental challenge, which is formidable. We need a quantum field theory of the Schrödinger equation, and we said that the Hamiltonian, which abstractly is given in terms of the field and its canonically conjugate momentum field is representable in the phi representation, that is to say in the basis, given by the joint eigenvectors to all of the field operators, phi hat, is representable in terms of phis and pis that are represented as multiplication and differentiation operators on the wave function L. So here's the Hamiltonian in that representation. This corresponds to writing down the Schrödinger Hamiltonian in non-relativistic quantum mechanics in the position representation, where these would be, you know, multiplication and differentiation operators. I was just about to say that it is convenient to move from the position to the momentum representation, as we saw earlier. And while we are at it, we might as well also put an infrared cutoff so that we get only a discrete set of momenta. And that has the advantage that these functional derivatives become just ordinary partial derivatives. Because instead of having a continuum of variables phi of x, we only have, after Fourier transform, we only have a discrete set of variables phi of k and pi of k. So now in the momentum representation, we can also represent our fields phi and pi again. But the commutation relations that they have to obey are now these. And we can represent them by representing the phi, again, as a multiplication operator, and the pi as a differentiation operator. It's just mathematically better defined now because we don't need the functional derivative as in the derivation of Euler-Lagrange equations from an action. Instead, it's just ordinary partial derivatives with respect to the phi, of which there are only a discrete set now, right? Remember that these k values are momentum vectors from a discrete lattice of momentum vector, because momentum is the momentum space is now discretized because everything happens in a box. And here are these discrete momentum vectors again. The n1 to n3 are positive and negative integers, and we have here 2 pi over L. So now we can finally write down the Schrödinger equation. This one, except, oof, I was trapping myself here. We write down the Schrödinger equation, but now for the quantum field theoretical Hamiltonian and choosing the phi hat, the eigenbasis of all the phi hat operators in the momentum representation, in the momentum space. And then that's the Schrödinger equation. So we have I h bar d by dt of the wave function L. Remember what that is? Psi of phi and t is the probability amplitude for finding the field configuration phi at time t. So the time derivative of that wave function L is given by the Hamiltonian acting on the same wave function L. And I'm putting tildes here because we're dealing with the Fourier transform, right? We're not dealing with the phi of x, but we're dealing with the phi of k. Right, and this is the Hamiltonian now. Again, the canonically conjugate momentum field is represented by the derivatives, and the field phi itself is represented by multiplying with phi. And this is now a very explicit Schrödinger equation that you could go about solving. What is it really? It's for every k a harmonic oscillator. Second derivative here, right? And then you have a quadratic potential. Now, let us remember what the ground state wave function is for the quantum harmonic oscillator in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. The ground state wave function for the harmonic oscillator of non-relativistic quantum mechanics is given by, up to a normalization constant, that doesn't really matter, it's given by a Gaussian, right? The ground state of the harmonic oscillator is a Gaussian. And it is time dependent. Every eigenstate of the Hamiltonian is time dependent, except if the energy is zero. But here it's not zero, it's this. So we have minus I omega t, that's just the time dependence of that ground state. So it's not really changing its probability distribution at all, because that's just a phase. I mean, you calculate the modulus square, it will drop out. So similarly, because that is just a bunch of harmonic oscillators, we find that the wave function L in the Klein-Gordon theory is this. This wave function L solves that Schrödinger equation. It's not the only solution. It's the solution that corresponds to the ground state of each of these harmonic oscillators. See, for every k, we have a harmonic oscillator. And if it is in its ground state, its wave function is this. Actually, this 1/2 stretches all the way to here, right? Because the energy is 1/2 h bar omega. So this is a typo here. So for every one of these harmonic oscillators, we have a ground state wave function. It's this. Now, that's not the only solution that we could write down. We could also write down, for example, a solution where we have this, except for one harmonic oscillator, it might be in its fifth excited state. We know what that is. The wave function of a harmonic oscillator in its fifth excited state is given by this Gaussian times the fifth Hermite polynomial. We could do that too here. So we have the fifth Hermite polynomial here for that particular choice of state. So you see, we are solving actually the Schrödinger equation for the wave function L without trouble, because it's just harmonic oscillators. We know how to solve them individually, so we know how to solve them all together. Now you also see why it was beneficial to go to the momentum representation. It's because in the momentum representation, these harmonic oscillators are not coupled to each other, so we can solve them individually. And that's why we can easily just choose anything that we know, all the solutions that we know for the harmonic oscillators here. And we can write down, of course, linear combinations of these wave functions, and they will be wave functions as well, or wave function Ls. So for example, very concretely now, we could say, well, so what is the probability amplitude for finding a particular field configuration if the state of the system is the ground state, lowest energy state, usually also called the vacuum state, even though technically the vacuum state is a no particle state. But in Minkowski space, that's the same. So if the system is in the ground state, in the lowest energy state, then we have that all of these harmonic oscillators are in their ground state, clearly, because if one of them was excited, the energy overall would rise. So the vacuum state is the state described by all of these ground states here. And remember that these harmonic oscillators are not identical. They have different k values, and therefore different omegas, different frequencies. So let's say we assume that the field is in the vacuum state, in the lowest energy state. Therefore, the wave function L is this one. And then we ask, what's the probability amplitude that if we measure the field everywhere, that its field configuration is going to be whatever, something like this? How would we calculate that from that? Well, we take the field configuration that we are asking about, and we Fourier transform it so that we get, you know, initially it's phi of x, but then we Fourier transform it, we get the phi of k, the phi tilde of k. And that phi tilde of k we plug into here, and then we get the probability amplitude out of that.
I have a hard time seeing what the normalization would be, because it's like a Gaussian over a sum of a countably infinite.
Yes, it looks bad, but it's not so bad, because for it's infinitely many harmonic oscillators, but for each one of them, you can write down the normalization so that it's fine. And since they're independent, it's not a problem.
Oh,
if on the other hand, when you have non-trivial interactions, then indeed, if you study the quantum field theory of interacting particles, such as fermions interacting with bosons and so on, for the purpose of accelerator physics, for example, then for the reason that you're pointing out, you actually get what is called a wave function renormalization. So you have to worry about that. The renormalization would not be trivial to handle. You would have to manually truncate it so that it's not an actual infinity, because you can't separate it individually. And then as you remove that truncation, you have to be super careful. And ultimately, the strategy is that you remove the normalization while letting other parameters such as masses and coupling constants run in just such a way that some experiments come out right. And then all the other experiments can be predicted. That's how renormalization works. But fortunately, for our purposes, quantum field theory for cosmology, we don't need to worry about this. And the reason is that quantum field theory for cosmology, as far as we know now, so far, right, could change, we actually only need to know the quantum field theory of free theories, of non-interacting Klein-Gordon fields on a curved background. And therefore, those particular issues don't come up. All the non-trivialities come from the interaction of the field with gravity. But that's not of the same kind as the interaction between photons and electrons, for example. Gravity provides a different, it interacts with the quantum fields in a different way. As we will soon see, the main difference is the following. I'm just saying it because you raised the issue. Consider a harmonic oscillator. For example, is your laptop charged? Because mine is not. Could I just get the charging cable for a sec?
Not sure.
Okay, great, thanks. So let's consider, for example, this pendulum here, right? So here we have a pendulum. And one way to excite the pendulum is to move it around like this, right? Now, as we said, harmonic oscillators all over the place in quantum field theory. How do they get excited? In other words, how do particles get created, right? Now, normally, it works like this. You have a harmonic oscillator of some mode. And then in order to excite it, essentially, some other field does this. Right? And then this harmonic oscillator gets excited. It's what is called external driving. So you have in the harmonic oscillator equation of motion, you have a driving term. You have an f of t on the right-hand side. However, that's not how gravity produces particles. That's not how the Unruh effect or the Hawking effect or cosmological particle creation works. It works differently. See, if you have a harmonic oscillator like this, then and it oscillates a bit, then you can make it oscillate more or less just by pulling on the string. Pulling on the string. And you see, if I do that at the right rhythm, I make actually the amplitude larger. I could also do it at another rhythm, and then I would make the amplitude smaller. That is what is called parametric driving. I'm changing, in this case, I'm not having external driving force on the harmonic oscillator equation. No. It's a free harmonic oscillator without driving force, but the omega of t. I make that time dependent. You see, if I change the length of the pendulum, I'm changing the natural frequency of it. And just by changing the natural frequency, I can actually excite the harmonic oscillator too. At that point, you might object. And you might say, well, if this thing is hanging down and I pull it up and down, it's not going to make it oscillate. I mean, if it was a proper straight thing, right? It's not going to oscillate if I just pull it up and down, made it shorter and longer. So. Yes, exactly. If it's a quantum harmonic oscillator, it cannot just straight hang down. It always has to oscillate a bit. There's always something going on, which means that for a quantum harmonic oscillator, you can parametrically excite it. And nature does not miss this opportunity. It does it, right? And that's how you get Hawking radiation, how you get Hawking particles being created. So it's a different way of how particles get created or annihilated through gravity. All the other fields just excite each other through regular driving, but gravity does this. Essentially, because in the D'Alembert operator, gravity enters. And so, for example, it's a gravitational wave, so just time dependence over that, the D'Alembert operator changes. by Fourier transform, this means that the momenta change, that the frequencies change, and that drives the harmonic oscillators. We will see all of that in great detail. Okay, so now if we have a generic wave function now, so assume that the system is in some state alpha. A generic wave function now. It doesn't have to be the state of the vacuum. It doesn't have to be the lowest energy state. There could be stuff going on in this quantum field. So some of the mode oscillators, or maybe all of them, are not in the ground state. Then what does that mean? For the ground state, the probability distribution for finding the field amplitudes is static. But if you have, let's say, a harmonic oscillator, but it's not in its ground state, it's also not in its fifth excited state, it's not in an eigenstate. It's in a linear combination of its eigenstates, right? Then what? Well, then you could have a wave function somewhere in the harmonic oscillator, and it slashes around in the potential, right? And similarly for a quantum field. That thing can happen there too. In other words, we should expect that, unlike in this case, where the wave functional doesn't actually depend on time, in general, it will depend on time. Why does it not depend on time here? Isn't there 1/2 omega t? It is there, but it's just a phase, right? It's just a phase, which means that when you take the modulus square of it, that drops out. Whereas these coefficients really matter. They're real. Right? Okay, so you saw today that we can do the Schrödinger equation for quantum fields. We obtain wave functionals and their dynamics according to the Schrödinger equation. You saw how you can build these probability distributions, therefore, for field configurations. And therefore, in principle, you can now calculate for every field configuration what the probability is that you find it. And that's one way of doing it. So last time we did another way of doing it, which is that you calculate probability distributions a little differently. But in any case, I will give you another even more convenient way of calculating the probability distributions for field fluctuations that is based on what we saw earlier. And then from that, you will be able to actually generate them on the computer and explore them in various circumstances. Okay, so that's it for today.